If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone. It's Thursday morning, the 10th of March, 2022, and you're listening to The Tillage Podcast. I'm Stephen Robb, currently self-isolating in Donegal.
I'm Andy Doyle in Kildare.
Siobhan Walsh in Leash.
So we're now 2 weeks into the Russian war in Ukraine. And while we all watched with horror during week one of this conflict, through our TVs, through our phones, and of course by reading the newspaper, it still felt like it was some way far off and that we weren't really feeling the direct consequences of it. But week two has been an entirely different story. And it's safe to say that the war has hit our way of life like a train. The consequences of this war are still unfolding, and to be honest, it's difficult to give you the full picture because we ourselves don't have the full picture. But as always, in this week's Farmers Journal, we have the latest analysis from all the team about what this means for you and your farm. I have a copy of it here in front of me, and as always, I'm joined by Andy and Siobhan, and we're going to bring you through the key points that you need to know this week. So, guys, we normally start this podcast with what's happening in the fields, but I'm going to leave that to later on in the podcast because I want to get straight into the Ukraine coverage. And I'm going to start with the news which broke on Saturday night and Sunday morning, and which caused quite a stir in the tillage industry, to say the least. And that was the Minister of Agriculture's comments around considering incentives or something or some kind of scheme to get farmers to grow wheat, oats and or barley in anticipation of feed shortages this winter. So I guess to begin with, guys, where did these comments come from? When did they make them? And really, what did he say and what did he mean?
It's difficult to know. Well, I certainly don't know exactly where they came from, but I think the minister has been on record on a number of occasions of trying to address the issues faced by the tillage sector. And government policy is now to stabilize or increase the area sown to tillage crops. And this was probably seen just on the face of it, at least, as a way to attempt to do that. And, for some, it might be seen as good news to try and get more acres. For others, it was seen as almost an insult in terms of being asked yet again to solve somebody else's problem whilst being ignored in every other day and every other year. And that's kind of the mix of reactions that has come from it. There was also a big backlash from the grassland-based or livestock sector in terms of their ability to grow a crop and the fact that it would upset their way of life. And, to a fair degree, that was correct. You know, the idea of trying to grow crops where crops couldn't grow climate-wise or shouldn't be asked to grow fertility-wise, it would not be the best use of that land in terms of trying to produce either food or feed going forward. So, you know, there was a definite backlash, and that has tempered the various reactions that have subsequently occurred. I think it's probably fair to say that the Department of Agriculture were almost totally unaware that this was incubating and were left with the issue of having to deal with it after it being said. I might be slightly wrong in that, but that's my understanding of the way it unfolded. And certainly there was a huge amount of activity through the weekend and into the early days of the week before that meeting with the farm orgs on Tuesday. That's kind of where it stands at the moment.
We won't remember, but this has happened before. And that's kind of where a lot of the commentary was was coming from around Ireland's in a war footing now and we need to increase food production. But I think it just caught the industry, caught tillage farmers by surprise. It literally came out of nowhere, or so it seems. But I guess is it to be welcomed though? I mean, is this just good foresight? Does the minister see something coming that the rest of us might not see coming in terms of feed shortages into the winter? I mean, are we likely to see a shortage of grain in light of this war in Ukraine?
Well, look at Stephen, if you take it that all exports or almost all exports from Ukraine and Russia will be unavailable to the world market, that is grain exports, then we're losing 25% of the grain that's traded annually, or roughly 100 million tonnes. There's about 400 million tonnes of grain traded in the world every year. So to lose 25% of that is massive in terms of what's traded. But could the world do without 100 million tonnes if certain actions were taken? Arguably, the answer is yes. Do we need to feed all the animals in this country concentrate? We need to feed them concentrate to get the performance, but is that performance level absolutely necessary? So these are all questions that are now being asked as a consequence of this. In answer to your question about, should we be welcoming this, I think the tillage sector should be welcoming a move to increase the importance of the crops that we produce in the overall context of food production. But of course, we produce very little actual food. It all has to be processed because we don't have a milling industry to make bread or flour or biscuits or any of those things. That is an industry of any size, that is. And the only other food product we produce is porridge. So, all of those things need to be looked at. And I think, there will be some people probably asking the question, could we be thinking of having a flour mill in the country? Should we be thinking of finding other ways to access other supplies of grain or grains or substitutes going forward? I think the great thing that people are beginning to realize is that an awful lot of these feedstuffs that are coming into the market are byproducts of either the grain or oilseeds industry. And as soon as you decrease the availability or supply of any of them, you effectively decrease the supply in the whole food chain. And it is not inconceivable that a lot of the products or a number of the products that we have come to rely on in recent years for the feed sector may not be available or may not be available in sufficient quantities in the year stroke years ahead. In the short term, we're looking at trying to satisfy 2022. But the bigger pressure is 2023 and beyond, because at that stage, none of what has been produced in Russia will come into the Western world market. And there may be a lot less produced in the Ukraine if they're going to be prevented from planting this season. So the problem isn't just a 2022 problem. It has to be addressed for further down the road.
But Siobhan, surely this is, I mean, that's why I posed the question, like, should this be welcomed? Surely from an All-Ireland sustainability point of view, this needs to happen. We need to increase our native feed production.
Yeah, we do. And, we've been saying we need to increase our native production. And as Andy said, like, we don't have, we used to have a milling industry in this country and we don't now apart from a few small outlets. I suppose, like, understandably, there was, we got phone calls from tillage farmers earlier in the week who are frustrated, that it was announced over the weekend, I suppose, the way it was. But in general, I think the move needs to be welcomed. But we still don't know what the minister has planned. And I suppose they met on Tuesday and they'll meet again. I think it's next Tuesday. So we don't know what the plan is to increase our feed in this country. I'd say it's probably moved to, I'd say from the meeting yesterday, things have probably moved from maybe, is there an opportunity to grow more forage crops or whatever? But I mean, the logistics and practicalities of increase in the area sown to cereal crops in particular, you know, is not simple. So we're already you know, tight on stocks of fertilizer in the country. Those crops that are planted will have to be sprayed, they'll need seed. And as well, you know, Andy, I heard you saying it during the week, where would extra grain be stored as well? We don't have the storage capacity in this country. So, you know, it's not simple, I suppose, and there's lots of things to be discussed, which that committee has been set up to do.
So just on that committee and on the meeting with the minister on Tuesday evening, do we know, first of all, what farm orgs were there? Who was there representing tillage farmers?
So, the Irish Grain Growers and the IFA were there, which would be the main representatives of the tillage sector. The other organisations were there then as well, the ICSA, the ICMSA, MOCRA. There was a host of organisations there, but representing the tillage industry particularly would be the IFA and the Irish Grain Growers.
And do we have any idea of what actually was said, talked about, or if anything really concrete came from the meeting, or was it just a talking shop?
Stephen, my understanding is that people went possibly expecting to find a plan on the table. That was never going to be the case. The idea was conceived far too recently to have any chance of having a plan on the table. The minister's suggestion at the weekend was for more grain crops to be grown. I think the focus of the meeting, because the grain was fundamentally as a feedstuff, the focus of the meeting seemed to gravitate much more towards fodder than grain. Maybe that's not the wrong thing from their point of view, because if they have enough of fodder, animals can at least be kept ticking over. And whether or not then you use grain, because grain will be very expensive, most likely, regardless of where it comes from, because the price is the price. And while we had to live under the cosh of world prices for many years, now the world price in a sense is high, and also in Ireland, and there's no reason to believe that tillage farmers should expect to sell for less than what the equivalent is elsewhere if this happens. But look at grain prices are highly, highly uncertain through all of this. I watch them daily, and 50 euro fluctuation in price is quite common within 2 hours in the markets. It's just so subject to any little bit of news, any little bit of sentiment change.
We'll touch on that in a second, Andy. But just, I mean, across Europe, just off air, we had a conversation. Europe's actually, are they not surplus in production in terms of cereals?
Yes, Europe as a whole would be surplus to the tune of about 48 million tonnes, I think, of grain. Between 40 and 50 million tonnes of grain. And we import very roughly 20 million tonnes.
Is that Europe or the EU?
That's
the EU.
I'm guessing the bulk of the imports will be to do with all kinds of speciality products from milling or for other uses like that. So we are surplus, but the surplus that we have is also a part of the food chain that enters North Africa, in particular North African countries. So if we were to close our borders and not let grain out so that we had enough inside, then that massively aggravates the problem for other poorer countries in terms of generating food, not just feed, but food for them. So again, all of these issues are complex, because every action has an immediate reaction potential also. And it's so easy to knock the whole system out of balance. Arguably, it's already knocked out of balance, but at least within the Western world, there's some semblance of what people should do, might do, or could do. If the Western world becomes protectionist, then it's much more difficult to see how any of this can avoid very serious consequences for some people that might have to go very hungry.
Yeah, okay. So that committee is meeting next week again, isn't it? And now let's just say, for argument's sake, that a scheme of some kind came out to incentivize increased sowing of spring cereals. Do we know if we have enough seed if we have enough, we'll be able to access enough chemicals, if we're going to be able to access enough fertilizer, or even diesel to actually do this from a practical point of view.
We probably know some of the answers, Stephen. The reckoning is that there is surplus seed in the system for about 40,000 hectares. Now, that's a number. Is it a factual number? I'm not sure that we're certain of, because with grain prices gone to where they are, seed crops that were unlikely to be sold because they were going to be surplus could quite likely have found themselves going into the feed system because they were probably a lot more profitable than they would be if they were turned into seed, because of the cost of processing, etc. So nobody is certain exactly how much of the seed that was there is still there to fuel an increase in area if it was possible to get increased area. But seed probably never stopped tillage farmers from planting. They'd find it somewhere if it was going to be worth their while to do it. And, you know, there are things like we could consider derogations for seed that failed the germination test in order to get more crops into the ground. So there are lots of things that we could do. But if we do that, will there be enough of diesel to get the work done? Is there enough machinery capacity there? Probably the answer to that is yes, because we would not be increasing acreage any further than it was 5 or 7 years ago. So the machine capacity is probably there somewhere. But will there be diesel? Leave aside the additional cost of it. Will there actually be diesel there? Because people have to be very careful now about making sure that they have stocks to gather the harvest, whether that's a silage harvest or a grain harvest, because that would be the greater disaster if it wasn't possible to reap the crops that were sown, even the standard acreage, not the talk of the extra acreage. So that's a debate that kind of has to go on as well. I mean, some people believe there will be no scarcity of oil. Others are a lot more sceptical of that as a statement. Go to Ag Chems. I have a piece talking about the fact that the industry have the Ag Chems on hand in the country for this year's crop based on the acreage that was expected. If there was to be a significant spike in that acreage, then it's unlikely that that chemical would be on hand. Would it be possible to get it at this stage? Normally, there's a kind of 4 to 5 month lead-in time for orders of chemical to be delivered to member states. So that would be a really big problem. The question is asked then, would product that was destined for the Ukraine, which may not be used because crops may not be sown, or there may not be an opportunity to apply it because of the circumstances of the war, could that be made available? Well, the answer to that is that there's a strong probability that a lot of the products that they would use would have been long banned in the European Union.
Yeah, so, you know, of course.
Lots of issues.
Yeah. Okay. Just on the diesel issue, we'll chat about fertilizer after. A post doing the rounds on social media and WhatsApp, and I just want to read it out because it puts it into context. Esfriel Agri Contracts, they're actually a Donegal outfit, not too far away from myself, put a Facebook post up yesterday, and it reads as follows. 18 months ago, I could have filled this tank for €10,600. 2 weeks ago, I ordered a fill, and it was costing €19,200, and was told that it would take a few weeks because supplies are limited. I'm still waiting on my delivery, and at today's price, it's costing €29,000. Yes, that's €10,600. To €29,000 in 18 months. That to me summarized it perfectly, just the challenges that we're facing on the diesel and things, which was not talked about, let's be honest, until the past week or two. And we've seen a very poor response from the government so far in addressing that. On the fertilizer side of things, Siobhan, are we hearing anything around supply or prices or availability, or indeed, Andy, did anything come from the meeting? What are you hearing?
Yeah, sure. Look, fertilizer supply is expected to get tighter, I suppose, and prices, you know, we're hearing rumors of prices going up already. We're looking at probably over €1,000 per ton, but look, still a lot of speculation in the market at the minute. Yeah. Hopefully farmers won't see those price rises themselves yet. You know, merchants have some product in stock. So, Andy, I know you had some figures on fertilizer as well.
Yeah, I think it was discussed at the meeting, as I understand it, and there were suggestions that supplies generally are expected to be okay in the short term. The short term in the case of fertilizer now would be up to the middle or end of April. After that, things get a lot more questionable in terms of supplies. You know, physically getting them, the cost that would be put on them, and whether or not they would be affordable to use if the price keeps going in the direction that it's going. So look at all of these things are there, but there's not kind of a belief that there will be sufficient fertilizer or an endless supply of fertilizer. That's sure not there, but that wasn't there 4 months ago, regardless of this war, but certainly the war has exaggerated the difficulties that were in that market.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Stephen, I suppose just going back to some of the, you know, when we're talking about fertilizer, some of the crops like maize and beet are going to have, you know, they have a high fertilizer requirement. And I suppose, you know, maybe there's an opportunity there for the department to set up some sort of, you know, body to work, but to, you know, maybe a co-op or someone could work between farmers to set up agreements for forage. Or, you know, I suppose tillage farmers are wary of planting these crops because there's a high cost involved. And we've talked a lot about forage contracts on this podcast before, but, you know, if tillage farmers are going to grow these crops, they're going to need support to grow them. They're going to need, you know, money in the bank before they grow them, so they won't be left with these crops. And I suppose things like that this committee could try help set up would be a help. And, you know, in 2018 we had a drought in this country, and there was a fodder production incentive measure introduced, and, you know, maybe that's something to look ahead to as well. There's also a lot of gloss crops in this that could be grazed, and maybe we need to look at seed for those crops. You know, some of them are planted and they're not all suitable for grazing, so maybe we need to plan ahead and source, you know, more forage rape or whatever it may be, to, you know, they can all help to reduce the fodder deficit, or if that is there.
The difficulty there is if that's to happen as a real option, then the seed would want to be gathered fairly soon.
Exactly. But yeah.
Those crops, from a forage value point of view, need to be planted early.
Yeah.
And if fodder is scarce, then straw is likely to be valuable. There may be very little chopping, and one thing can get in the way of another. And that's kind of one of the things that tillage farmers have to be careful of. So if we're going to try and save straw and then get crops planted as early as possible, there may be a need for increased capacity somewhere in the system with contractors or whatever to get land cleared more quickly and to get crops in as quickly as possible, because sowing date equals yield of forage in those situations.
Yeah, but from a tillage farmer's point of view, I mean, if any such scheme like that came along, really you'd be targeting growers who are familiar with fodder crops and probably who's grown them in the past, because this is not a year to be taking risks, and it's really not a year to be to try and grow fodder beet, for example, for the first time, or maybe even maize. You know, you want to, this year you have to take all of the experience which you have gained in growing crops over your lifetime and put it into practice and steer this ship as best you can through the harvest. Because certainly, and Andy, we can talk about this next, the indication in grain markets, being as turmoil as they are, price is probably going to be decent this year. And if we do this right, and if we steer it right, we probably will make a profit this year. Now, I know there's a million and one caveats, and so many things can happen from now until then. And of course, it's all weather dependent. But, you know, that is the feeling on the ground.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that as a feeling at all, Stephen. You know, I certainly would be slow, as you suggest, to steer people towards fodder crops for the first time. I think you need to know your way around those. But the idea of going for fodder catch post-harvest, particularly where spring crops are growing, are to be growing. That's a good deal simpler operation. It doesn't have to involve expenditure other than the cost of the seed, if the seed is available. But there is a diesel cost, of course, regardless of how they're planted. If you lose a customer, the risk is not that big because it's organic matter on your land. But I would say chances are you probably won't lose a customer in the year that's here, particularly if the customer identified himself before you planted. Planting it on spec is always questionable, but if it's on spec, then be prepared to put it back into the ground, and then either way you're a winner.
Yeah, then of course, I mean, the three of us talked about this before, I'm not sure it was on the podcast, mind you, but you know, later on in the year, livestock farmers probably will have the opportunity to buy a crop off a standing, you know, for whole crop. So perhaps there's something that can be worked out there in the way of some kind of a scheme or incentive. Okay, so that explains where the talk of the scheme came from, the outcome, as we believe it, from the first meeting with the minister, and the sheer practicalities of any such scheme as we see it. And that brings us up to Wednesday evening, where we got some breaking news, and indeed it claimed page one of the Irish Farmers Journal this week, written by our colleague Declan O'Brien. So, as Irish Farmers Journal understands it, a multi-million euro package to significantly expand the area of feed and fodder crops is in the pipeline. The initiative comes as input and energy costs continue to soar and animal feed supplies tighten. Strong support for planting additional cereal and fodder crops this spring, along with increased incentives for multi-species swards and red clover, will form key planks of the government's strategy to reduce Ireland's dependence on imported feed and fertiliser. Andy, what do you make of the page one story this week?
Well, Stephen, it's probably just an extension of the conversations that had taken place with the farm orgs. I think it's probably fair to say that while a lot of reporting of that meeting would suggest that the government brought nothing to the table, it was in its infancy. And I think it feels after the meeting that it is possible to do something that would make a difference. And it's putting money behind that. That's what it seems like. That's the way I'm reading it at the moment. It's difficult. It's going to be difficult to kind of incentivize any major land use change of a significant degree. And it's also going to be extremely difficult to try and get that done in the short term. I know that one of the things that came from the meeting on Tuesday, I think it was now, was that Chagas got being charged with trying to get inventories on farm and in stock inventories of all the major inputs. So how much feed is in the country, how much fertilizer is in the country, etc. Because on that basis, the extent of a possible problem is likely to be accessible. And if it can be assessed, then the extent to which any move to increase fodder or food supply will be interesting. It's also interesting that that when the title was changed to a fodder and food, that the food angle could bring in lots of different directions to where this committee might go going forward. But some of it is certainly short term, but I think the bigger part of the work of that committee now will be to look at the long term vulnerability, even of the island of Ireland, which is supposed to be a food producing nation with a lot of exports. We export lots of stuff, but we still don't have that much food to feed our own people with.
Yeah, okay. Rapidly changing in front of our eyes, and look, as of course we'll stay up to date with it and keep all of our listeners up to date with what's happening. Just I see the National Fodder and Food Security Committee, which was set up are to meet the minister on Friday tomorrow. So there might be some news from that. So stay tuned. But for now, we're going to move on. Andy, I've been watching markets. Energy markets, metal markets, rare earth metal markets closely over the past couple of days, and sorry, over the past week, I should say. And it would not be good for your health, to put it lightly. It is phenomenal, the uncertainty, the swings, the gains, everything. What's happening in grain markets?
Same thing, Stephen. Things are relatively calm today, today and yesterday. I think that was, it came about, sorry, let me backtrack a second. On Monday, things went absolutely stone mad. We saw things moving by 50, nearby grains moving by 50 euro a ton on Monday. And you know, the highs in the market had wheat at 450. Now, we know that around those times, towards the weekend and early this week, there would have been wheat traded at 420 a ton. At this minute, it probably is below 400 because it's been fluctuating between that 390 mark and the 420 mark over the last number of days. And it's not fluctuating by the day, it's fluctuating by the minute of the hour of the day. And that literally is what's going on.
Our listeners, is that dry milling wheat or is that dry feed wheat? What is that?
That's Matif wheat, which is dry, low-grade milling, which is generally used to equate to Irish feed wheat because of the cost of import. So they're the ones that we would equate to a lot of the time. So, sorry, my prices, that 390 to 420, they're actual prices for dry wheat in Ireland between buyers and sellers. So it's more real. They're the prices that are being paid, with this price has been similar for wheat and barley. But it's probably also worth saying not that many farmers own grain still. So the bulk of this is between merchants and end users. And even for merchants, an awful lot of the grain that they bought last harvest is already sold or accounted for, and therefore not able to cash in on these extraordinary prices.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that surely makes any speculation out over the coming weeks or months damn near impossible when you have that level of volatility in markets.
100% correct, Stephen. If we look forward into December, or new crop, which is the one that we would be dealing with a lot of the time now in terms of people's decisions when they're planting, in the week, new crop December wheat went to 331. It's back around the 310, 315 mark midweek this week. So it went way up and it came way back again. But the fluctuation in new crop wheat is still much, much lower than it is in wheat that's needed for access to the market through March, April and May. But I can only see that the far out prices are going to sneak up bit by bit as time goes by, rather than the nearby prices falling dramatically. That's just the direction of travel. In the early days of conflict, you had all the big volatility happening in March contracts. Where can I get my hand on it today? When you watch markets now, that volatility is moving out to May contracts, where people may have secured nearby supplies and they're beginning to get concerned about what's happening further down the road. And I think that that pressure is likely to stay there in the market for quite a number of months, and I think probably spill out into years at this point. But hopefully it won't be years of this dramatic volatility that we're seeing now, because that's kind of, it's no good to any market. In theory, you can get it as a seller. In practice, nobody will sell in case that it's higher tomorrow. Extremely difficult for markets to function.
So, Andy, we would have obviously seen this week the comments from McConnell Logue in relation to the fears around Irish feed supply. Is that happening in other countries around Europe or around the world? Are we likely to see any kind of export bans of any kind coming being introduced?
I think, Stephen, the answer to that is yes. And I suppose, more importantly, it already seems to be happening, or countries are muting the possibility of it happening. Countries, politicians, etc., governments are trying to hold on to slow down internal inflation. And some of the countries in Europe, particularly on the eastern side of Europe, that would normally export modest quantities of grain, are beginning to close the ports. I know that I had instances of countries, I can't remember where exactly, But they hadn't banned exports, but it was getting a lot more difficult to get the export license. And that's an indication of a change in policy to slow exports, to try and protect internal suppliers on the one hand, and also to a small degree to pressure internal prices on the other. In fairness, that's what Russia had been doing for the last few years with its taxes. And now sanctions have replaced the need for all of those. It can have all its own grain because nobody is willing to take it. For the moment, I think it's not inconceivable in the next 8-9 months that countries will be taking Russian grain. In other words, they'll break ranks with the West. I think that's highly, highly likely.
Yeah, OK, interesting stuff. Look, guys, sticking with the Ukrainian coverage, that's on the food end of things. But equally as pressing and equally as dramatic as what's happening on the energy side of things. So over the weekend, we would have seen rumblings of European, UK and US governments considering bans on Russian energy to step up the sanctions. That's part of the reason why markets were so chaotic when they opened on Monday morning. I mean, we saw instant rises to record prices for gas in particular, and for oil. It was phenomenal. And they actually went ahead and they bit the bullet and they've done it. So UK have committed to phasing out Russian oil. Gas isn't so much of an issue for them. Same with the US. They've committed to phasing out immediately Russian oil. Again, not that big of an issue, really. I think it's only 7 or 8% or so of imports are from Russia. The EU, on the other hand, is in a lot more trouble. They have this week implemented some a serious package of measures to reduce the bloc's reliance on Russian energy, and it is going to have big implications for every one of us. So to put it in context, I know we ran through it last week, quick reminder, Russia supplies more than 40% of the EU's total gas consumption. The EU is a massive user of gas, so that's why we're so reliant on Russia, and that's why we're in a bit of trouble here. About 27% of oil imports also come from Russia into the EU, and about 46% of coal imports. So there's a wide range of measures introduced or announced this week by the European Commission called REPowerEU. That's the name of the plan. The aim of it is to reduce the demand for Russian gas by 2/3 by the end of this year, and to put in a series of measures which will completely cut our dependence on Russian fossil fuels by 2030, if not earlier. So there's a whole range of measures here. So there is one of them is the EU is going to diversify its gas supplies through higher liquefied natural gas and pipeline imports from non-Russian suppliers such as Qatar, the USA, Egypt, West Africa, Norway, and a few other locations. The second measure is going to involve ramping up renewable energy production and energy efficiency. Now, we've heard this before, so we have, and we've seen some ambitious targets set in the past by Europe, but this is just next level stuff. It includes a target for producing an additional 15 million tonnes of renewable hydrogen by 2030, doubling the EU's solar PV and wind capacities by 2025, and tripling this by 2030, and doubling its rate of yearly heat pump installations. To finance these measures, they're talking about a temporary windfall tax on the profits of some electricity producers, those who are benefiting from the high electricity prices. But the big game changer for agriculture, and this is utterly massive as far as I see it, they have committed to channeling some of the CAP funding to be used to ramp up biomethane production. Biomethane produced from anaerobic digestion plants. It's a renewable gas, which is a direct substitute for natural gas. So this is really an attempt to double the volume of renewable biomethane gas produced across the bloc to help wean itself off Russian gas. They have set an EU-wide biomethane target of 35 billion cubic metres by 2030. So as we understand it, and there's very little details of it other than what was announced on the conference earlier on in the week, basically, as we understand it, member states are going to have to adjust their CAP strategic plans and show how they're going to channel funding to biomethane produced from sustainable biomass sources, in particular agricultural waste and residues. So that would mean revisions to Ireland's draft strategic plan, which has already been submitted. It was submitted to Europe last December. And we have zero confirmation as to whether the CAP budget is going to be increased to facilitate this. There's so many unknowns about this, but, and I could be wrong on this, but as far as I see it, it's probably is the only, or certainly the biggest, intervention or channeling of CAP funding towards energy markets. I don't think we've ever seen that before, certainly not in this scale. So we're going to delve into this a lot more once more details come out and once we can get our hands on more details. But there's a dramatic shift happening, and everything from food to energy policy right across the EU, and it's happening in front of our eyes. And it's happening a lot quicker than anyone would have imagined. And unfortunately, I really think there's going to be a lot of short-term pain because of it. But you could argue that it's still in line with European policy. You know, it was the European Commission Executive Vice President Frans Timmermans who announced all of these measures. And he is, as I understand it, staunchly pro-renewables anyway. So they're really just accelerating their timeline. So we have big, big changes coming down the line. That's where we're at with the situation at the moment, as we understand it. So from there, guys, I think we'll park the Ukrainian coverage. And I know we spent a lot of time on it this week in the podcast, but look, how could we not? It's utterly incredible what's going on at the moment. So let's bring it back into the fields. Now, I know that the weather broke this week. We saw quite a bit of snow in places, funny enough. But before that, there was a good bit of field work going on. Siobhan and Andy, what have you been seeing out and about in the fields over the past 7 days?
Yeah, rain on Tuesday, and I suppose a really heavy rain, and that rainfall warning on Wednesday put a stop to work. But I think up to then, there had been a lot of activity in fields. I was out on the road this week, and I suppose I saw a lot of fertilizer spreaders moving, people getting compound onto winter crops. And unfortunately, that rain has come after. But look, I think farmers had no option. Crops needed that fertilizer, and you know, they had an opportunity to get it onto those crops. There's a lot of ploughing has been going on in the last few days as well, and bits of planting going on as well. People trying to get beans in, and even spring crops in as well. But I think overall, and maybe you'll hear differently to me on this, but beans, the area isn't as it's not increasing as was expected to. So I don't know, are you hearing that as well, Andy?
Absolutely hearing that, Siobhan, and it's interesting that I'm looking at the different minutes coming out of that meeting yesterday, and one of the suggestions on the table is to bring the new protein aid scheme forward, because that would certainly change the incentive for...
Can they actually do that, though, Andy?
The quick answer is no. But in a crisis, you can do everything you want.
Well, it wouldn't be the point. Government would be bringing the money. You would just, you know, that the increase in protein is coming in the next CAP. But I suppose if it came this year, it'd be the Irish government would be paying the money, is it?
Yes. Well, it's arguably, you know, the Irish government it's transferred within the CAP.
Yeah.
That's probably a fair thing to say. But it's interesting that those kind of things go onto the table, because they are practical. It's not that they're bringing the scheme forward, they're increasing the budget for the production of more this year through a national contribution, and that could be useful. But you know, it won't be long until the boat has sailed on pulse and combi crops, and if this was going to happen, it needs to be said now, because guys are going to put something into the field at the next possible opportunity.
Yeah, look, same up in this part of the world as well. Bit of ploughing, no sowing going on. Believe it or not, there was straw baled during the week. But yeah, weather's broke again and everyone's just waiting for things to kick off. I've seen some early spuds being planted as well in places.
I just got something in here that's just putting some numbers on things. And the number is stating that the fertilizer imports from Russia and Belarus into Ireland accounts for 23% of total fertilizer. A lot of that is compound, less of it is nitrogen. But I have a sneaky feeling that Russia is indirectly involved in a lot more of the fertilizer that comes in, because they supply the raw ingredients for the production of nitrogen, straight nitrogen compounds in many other European factories. So it may be designated as coming from one country, but it may have originated in a different country. And that's where the real uncertainty is in terms of what all this means.
Yeah, but as it stands, you know, at the time of recording this podcast, there's no indication that Russia are going to ban any exports of those materials.
No, but can anybody else take them in if you're boycotting Russia?
Yeah, but there's no indication that we're going to boycott Russia in terms of fertilizer. That hasn't been said anywhere yet, has it?
Let's wait and see.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the uncertainty, you know.
Exactly. And very few would have thought that we would have taken the measures to curb the importation of energy from Russia. But here we are. It's happened. Let's wait and see, is right.
There's a number of recorded instances already where ships managed to dock, but people with conscience refused to unload them. So that's the other side of the story.
Yeah. Okay. Right, Andy, thanks for that. Siobhan, this week you have looked through some of the slurry analysis results from Tullamore Farm. What did you find?
Yeah, I suppose, look, we're talking a lot about fertiliser and scarcity, and we need to make sure that we're using the fertiliser that's on farms or near our farms as efficiently as possible. And slurry testing is one way to do that. And I know we've talked about slurry testing before, but just, I suppose, interestingly, we tested the slurry on Tullamore Farm. Tullamore Farm's a livestock farm, but basically it's cattle slurry. So the Chagas Guide would say that NPK per 1,000 gallons of cattle slurry should be about 9,532. And the Tullamore Farm results just didn't reflect this. So the slurry from under the bulls was about 6.5 units of nitrogen, 0.72 units of phosphorus, and 3.67 units of potassium. I should note there that the bulls hadn't been receiving a lot of meal up to then, so I suppose phosphorus would be higher had they been receiving meal. And then just in the other samples, there were between 4 and 5 in nitrogen, 1 to 1.5 about in phosphorus, and 9 to 13 or 14 in potassium. So they're much lower than the Chagas Guide. And I'm not saying the Chagas Guide is the average that they get from across the country. But I suppose the reason that we're putting these low values in slurry down to is because the silage that the animals were eating is being made from grass growing on index 1 and 2 soils for P and K. So I suppose there's probably a lot of people out there thinking, I'll go by this guide and I'll put my slurry out and I might have enough P and K to cover whatever crop they're growing this year. But this really shows you the value of testing your slurry this year. And I know it's a dear year to buy compound, but I think in this case where the slurry is supplying such little nutrients, you know, a compound is probably needed here in order to make sure that you have a good crop of silage for next winter, or that you have a good crop of spring barley, or whatever it is that you're growing with the slurry. So I suppose it just shows the value of slurry testing, and it's on the Footprint Farmers page this year or this week.
That's really, really interesting. And even for any tillage farmer who would be importing slurry, they'll know themselves if it's a low input farm, to put it that their way, that might not just be as valuable as what some would lead you to believe.
Yeah, and we have the values there on the page according to prices that we used, you know, last week. So they're there as well on that page.
Okay, definitely one to check out this week. So Andy, on management this week, you're just commenting on fertilizer rates and now the uncertainty around grain price.
Yes, Stephen, and I suppose I've given the same message before, and arguably the message changes when the price of grain changes, and the cost of fertilizer changes, because it's back to how much can you afford to spend and actually get money from spending it, rather than spending more than you're getting back. And that's the challenge, and that's where that science of BER or break-even ratio comes in for every nutrient. Now, it's much easier to do that for nitrogen than it is for P and K. As Siobhan said, you know, P and K compounds, P and K straights, they haven't seen the same rises that the nitrogen fertilizers have seen. So they still represent value for money, particularly if you think you're looking at high value product at the end of the day. So I'm kind of saying, you know, nitrogen, you got to stand back and just think about what you're doing. The last thing in the world that people should do this year, given all of the uncertainty about all of the inputs, is to have their business overextended on credit when anything can happen yet in the season to cause real problem. I mean, from something as simple as bad weather to something as catastrophic as diesel scarcity and not being able to harvest crops. So there's, I think people need to think about the level of exposure and balance that against the potential for profitability in crops. I would have been saying, you know, take back P's and K's in certain soils, but in other soils, if you're going to stay farming them, you really have to put on a big amount to try and begin to build it. And I pose the question, on that type of land, will it carry that fertilizer investment this year? In other words, if it's a field that's only going to do 2.5 tonne of spring barley, given all the other costs, you probably can't afford to be spending anything much in it that's going to try and build fertility. It's the great dilemma of where we find ourselves. And that's why, you know, you would always say to people, keep your soil high in fertility. There'll be a day of comes when you have to cash it in. And that day is possible for those with index trees, certainly index fours, but even index trees. You don't maybe have to put on the full amount, but I would not put on some, because next year the prices of fertilizer may be no cheaper than they are this year.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly, Andy, for sure.
Yeah.
Again, said it before, but we'll say it again. The idea that this was a one-year blip has been totally obliterated. So it has, you know, this conflict is really upsetting the dynamics of things, and it's going to last for the foreseeable, we believe. So, Andy, to conclude, and we are a little bit over time, but I felt it was a good conversation, so we let it go on. What's happening in the weather for the week ahead?
Well, Stephen, probably like markets, only answerable in hindsight. Nonetheless, we can see the forecast, more rain in the forecast than there was for the past week, for sure. A few days here and there with zeros, but when there's zeros and other amounts in different regions, there's always the risk of rain and showers. So it's best described as broken for the week ahead, but certainly considerable rain forecast towards the weekend for the southwest and west of the country in particular. Most other areas, the overall amounts forecasted, not that big, thankfully. In terms of wind, wind speeds are occasionally up and occasionally down, so not that much drying, but arguably wind speed is no major advantage unless you're seeing the sunshine and no rain falling. Temperatures rising for just kind of today-ish, falling back again by night for the rest of the 7 days of the forecasted week. But daytime temperatures beginning to rise a bit, so we might see a little bit more in the line of growth for the week ahead.
Okay, Andy, thank you for that. And indeed, thank you for all of your knowledge and contributions over this podcast, and the same with you, Siobhan, and thank you to everyone for tuning in for another week. But time has got the better of us, so until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.